what we have to do, see, when we apply our practice, and some of us have put in a good number of years, and we clearly have to know what the direction is, and we clearly have to understand, see, what it is that we hope to achieve. We can pretend, and there are those who will give these talks about, I don't want anything, I'm perfectly content to not, to simply sit here and bask in the wonders. So I gave a talk once for, well, Maizumi Roshi was still alive, and I entitled the talk, What's in it for me? And that's kind of a shocking thing, but the truth of the matter is that's what it's all about. Each and every one of us is here, and we do have a personal agenda for coming to this place. And it's legitimate to say, what's in it for me? And we're here, see, much like going to the doctor, say, for the eyes, or Gyonin's mother's up here now. Hopefully it's something that won't be too serious, but could be kind of serious, see? Always there's something that needs to be taken care of. And as a sentient being, see, living in the world of samsara, see, there is the worst kind of illness. See, and this, see, is the fear and the suffering, see, of unfulfilled spiritual practice. And the great physician in this, see, the great physician was the Shakyamuni Buddha. And he was the healer. And he diagnosed, see, the most serious, see, and painful illness that can afflict a sentient being, see. And it's spiritual despair, a hopelessness, see, that can overtake us. It seems that there is always something, see, just below the surface that makes us feel terribly insecure. And in some instances, we're confronted, see, with the kinds of situations, if we lose someone, or if we watch someone in our family, particularly if they're younger, if we watch them, see, we develop a very serious illness, and we can watch their lives waste away. Or in this particular instance, I think in terms of the despair of this father, I don't know if any of you saw that, but when he wrote about seeing his son's casket come back from Iraq, and the horror, see, and he said, this is the end. And he said, people don't realize. See, and I think even in terms of this despair, this spiritual despair, and if you don't resonate to it, see, if it doesn't bother you, see, what's going on in your name? See, in Afghanistan, are you watching the number of soldiers that are dying? And each time one of those soldiers dies, see, and is brought home, and we should see the caskets. See, actually, much like Vietnam in World War II, we should actually have cameramen there, you know, filming the battlefield. We should know what's going on in our name. And if you can appreciate that each time one of those caskets comes home, an entire universe is distorted, disturbed, and goes into the worst kind of despair. See, a universe blinks out, but in this interdependency, there's a mother and a father. There may be a sister or a brother. There may be a husband or a wife. See, that their universe is twisted and torn forever. And to what end? To what end? See, this is the disease, and this is the place of spiritual despair. I don't call religion, I call it spiritual despair. Buddha looked out. See, he looked out from this protected environment that he sits in. And each one of us sits in that protected environment. We've got some youngsters here still, see. And they feel, they may intellectually be quick and clever, and they say, oh yes, I realize, see, that I am mortal. But they don't really have the same sense of it. See. They are living, see, in this comfort zone, this rich palace, because they are physically, see, and emotionally resilient. Something come by, causes a little bit of physical discomfort. They're not too concerned about it because I'm young, I'm strong, I'll bounce back. And always, see, emotionally, see, we'll bounce back. Sure, the party flamed out this weekend, but oh boy, next weekend will it fly. And he's laughing as he's moving on there. He's appreciating, see, that, well, and you've got to remember this was a rock musician. See, he knew that sense of immortality. But even there, and I jest, but he'll tell you, the members actually of your band and stuff have been dying, right? Yeah, see, they're all gone. See, they're all gone. And I don't know if you know, see, I say this, but I mean, he wasn't just a band playing around the edges. He was a Grammy Award winner. See, that's a significant recognition. But where are they? See, this is the world of samsara. See, this is the world of samsara. There is always that stuff. If the soldier coming home, where is your son? Where is your daughter? Where is your father? Where is your husband? Where's what? See, your world will be changed, and it's like that. See, we don't have to look at Afghanistan or Iraq. But see, again, you could really question the people who are trying to make us secure. Can they make us secure? See, now understand, the worst that they'll experience is a drop in popularity. And that isn't much to put out there on the line. Oh, geez, I'm not as popular. They don't approve of what I'm doing. See, again, we have to be very, very careful. See, we really have to be able to diagnose with absolute accuracy. And that's why the Shakyamuni Buddha was called the great healer. Kogyo's not here today, but he's been doing practice with the medicine Buddha. See, and I'm a believer, a strong advocate of this. Strong advocate of this. See, the most important part of any of these, and we're using a sort of a medical model here, see, is an accurate diagnosis. An accurate diagnosis. See, it was in his deep meditation that the Shakyamuni Buddha realized that the law of causation, and we'll just leave it with that, the law of causation was underlying all suffering. See, but the law of causation is extremely difficult to understand. So Buddha, see, in this great realization, this great insight that he had, see, initially said, how can I ever explain this? It can't be done. See. So he organized his teachings, see, into the form of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths. And these Four Noble Truths, see, are the clarification. See, it's bringing the law of causation, see, down into the language that we can all understand. See, and it's very simple. See, there's the suffering, see, the cause of the suffering, the extinction of suffering, see, and the path to attain this. The path to attain what? See, again, if you think that this is the path to attain spiritual standing, spiritual status, see, it's not that at all. See. To escape from the place that you find yourself is an impossibility. See, it is to eliminate the suffering and the transformation of the personality. See, you can sit all you want if you simply are playing in your head, and then you allow yourself to go back into the same insensitive patterns of behavior. See, with some of you, see, I try in subtle ways to get you to look at that. And then sometimes, if you don't look enough, then I have to bang into you. I know it's not pleasant. It's not pleasant for me. See, but it is something that needs to be done. It is medicine that needs to be administered. And this is where we have to be very, very careful. See, the Maizumi, the Shakyamuni Buddha, see, in diagnosing, see, the problems, see, and giving verbal expression to these problems through the Four Noble Truths, see, was speaking in a way that relates to our daily activities. See, your day-to-day activities. See, the First Noble Truth simply states that all existence ultimately ends in suffering. And we must be aware that the incorrect diagnosis, see, which is dualistic understanding, see, generated behind a personal agenda, see, doesn't correct the disease. As a matter of fact, can actually make the disease more difficult to deal with. We see this in much of what we would call institutionalized religion. Rather than eliminating, see, the fear, see, and the anxiety, see, of the dualistic world, it actually causes us to be more deeply entrenched in this sense of separation. And when I'm entrenched in this separation, I am deeply, deeply immersed in what? What is the basic ground of ego? Fear. Fear. See? And the interesting part, if you don't see this, see, then you're going to go along, you're going to continue, see, to function in the same way, see, to continuously, see, lead yourself into the places of pain and suffering and anxiety, driven behind your egocentric agenda. See, and most of the people here don't even really want to look at, don't talk to me about that. Let me have some kind of a role or something that can lift me to a place where people stand and they think, isn't this person wonderful? Look what I can do for you. See, and there, if you can get involved in those kind of things, and it doesn't matter from which side. See, you could be the one. See, and we see these charismatic leaders. See, that's what part of what Mazen and I was talking about today. That charismatic leader can exploit. And as a matter of fact, we don't even have to think in terms of charismatic leaders. You simply look at some of the established religions. See, they don't diagnose accurately because they don't have the healers there to diagnose. The diagnosis, see, is misapplied. And consequently, you can't treat the illness. It would be like if I walked in the door and I've got a shattered thigh bone and the doctor says, let me look into your ears to see what's wrong. See, you've got to be able to see that I have a broken leg before you can treat it. You have to make the accurate diagnosis. And then the application of treatment. See, now Buddha, see, and this, to make certain that the cure is effective, see, we have to make certain, again, as I was saying, that it's been accurately diagnosed. And then the Buddha with the second of the Four Noble Truths, which is the truth of the cause. And he points out here that illusion and desire, see, are the causes of suffering. And it's a kind of an interesting thing if we look at the law of causation. See, illusion and desire. Now here we have to be very, very careful. Because again, if we can't accurately read, see, the prescription, see, that the healer has written out for us, we can make the wrong assumption. Because ultimately you are the one who is going to apply the treatment. He says, illusion and desire are the cause of suffering. See, if the cause is understood, by eliminating the cause, one eliminates the suffering itself. Now, this is where you have to be very, very careful. And the way most people, and certainly I think today there's been changes, I hope there's been changes, primarily because most of the scholars of this the current time here in the United States, many of them had at various times contact with Maizumi Roshi through the Kuroda Institute. And while it's true that some of them were completely, you know, involved in their own self-importance, but some of them would listen and begin to hear. See, it isn't desire, see, that is the problem. And it sounds, in a certain sense, see, that if you've got to give up desires, see, and how do we respond to, oh my God, I have to give up my desires, see. Well, then how do I do that? Well, see, I have to cut off all feeling. See, I have to cut off all involvements. See, I can't be entangled in any of the emotions, see, that human beings, see, are prone to. See, as a matter of fact, by definition, see, we are creatures of emotions. See, so what are we going to become? And this is part of what they have done. They try to bring an ascetic's form of cut off all desires. See, it's interpreted that way. And when I started out, see, I had a friend that was terrified him. See, oh, those desires. I have desires for certain things. I have the desire for the perfect partner, the perfect mate. I have desire for success. See, and in a sense, see, these desires, and all desires, there are desires that are harmful, see, in the very nature of what they are. Because I can identify the desire for drugs. See, that's a harmful desire. Get rid of that desire. But you know how difficult it is to simply say, I won't go to my addiction? I won't go to the addiction. I won't smoke that cigarette. I won't take that drug. See, I think you could probably, so Tetz can tell you, watching people who realized what they were doing, trapped in these desires, killed them. See, I had friends like that, see. Then what do you become? An automaton? A zombie? And as a matter of fact, that's how it's often described. See, I know in one instance, they talk about Buddha, who had freed himself from all worldly desires. See, and how he was described as walking along the path with his eyes down and this smile. See, who wants to live like that? Walk around devoid of any feelings, devoid of any emotions. See, with a little smile, what's he smiling about? See? And it's been described like that. See, it isn't the desire. See, it's the attachment. The way we attach to things, and attachments are driven behind this expectation of outcome. And this has to do with the dualistic mind. This is that picking and choosing mind that causes us all sorts of trouble. We have seen how throughout history, where people decide that they are literally going to legislate against any desires. See, and we have seen this in things called inquisitions. See, where somebody is going to dictate to you appropriate behavior and punish inappropriate behavior, because people always exploit that. See, from the egocentric world, see, we try to control by force. And it has never worked. It does not, see, snuff out, see, the pain and suffering of samsara. See, but we have to know what is the proper application. See, the diagnosis, see, is this sense, see, of separation, this sense of being isolated, of the sense of sitting in a world where it is totally enclosed in fear. And that's what the egocentric world is all about. And consequently, we're trying always to find some way, see, of remedying or eliminating this fear. And how do we do it? by trying to acquire more things, by becoming more judgmental, more guarded, see, pushing away those things that we don't like, see, and trying to hold on to the things that we do like, and see if this isn't how we function. But again, there, you see, you're going against, see, the actual diagnosis that Buddha talked about. See, the illusion, what? The illusion of you being separate. See, and in this illusory body, which is the body you sit with here, where you experience yourself as separate from everything there, see, what drives that sense of separation? See, I want certain things in certain ways. That reinforces it. See, and if I try through punitive acts, see, through acts of great asceticism to punish myself, we actually, see, bind ourselves more tightly with this rope, see, of separation. See, I have to hold strong against the world out there. Do you see that? See, the world out there isn't out there. See, that is the delusional mind, or the illusory mind, of the egocentric self, see, with an agenda. If I punish this center enough, if I punish myself enough, if I make myself so rigid and so dogmatic, see, somehow I'm going to eliminate my pain. We don't. We increase it. See, we increase it. See, it's a funny thing. See, the problem, see, is our attachment to our desires, and our attachment to the illusion. And for me, at least, see, this becomes a fascinating thing. Because I was one who began by thinking, geez, you know, when I started Buddha Dharma, I knew a lot about the pain and suffering. From very early on, I was aware of the pain and the suffering, and the just this general anxiety about life. See, some of you here have never probably been to a funeral. I just heard somebody was talking about that recently. Had never been to a funeral. See, so having no, I guess, was it you, Mushoku? Had never been to a funeral till recently. See, so for her, see, it's very much like not having the soldiers come home in a box. Not being aware of what you're asking somebody to pay. See, and then again, I want to hammer on this, the hypocrisy of a politician, see, or a CEO of some company who talks about the great sacrifice that must be made. See, then there was an era that probably, I don't know how we would judge it, when the military guys at least had to get out there. And occasionally they were killed in battle. I mean, what a kind of a level playing field there. See, but I was, in a certain sense, so acutely aware. By the time I was in the sixth grade, I'd been the pallbearer to two of my friends' funerals. See, and back there they have the tradition of, you know, the open casket and all of this. See, and for me as a little one, see, I can remember in the sixth grade riding on the bus home from where the funeral had taken place, and we'd gone out to the mortuary and they dropped us in the town. And I was really in a panic, see, a lot of anxiety, because this all seemed so abnormal to me. See, this horrific scene that I had looked at, and it was a horrific scene. See, here's friends that were had been just a short time before, they had been viable, they had been warm, they had been breathing bodies. And there they were. See, for me, they looked like the waxed fruit that my grandmother would put on the table. Some of you might have seen that was a big thing during that era, see. So I was terribly, terribly aware, see, of the consequences of a negative turn in a life. And I kept wondering, I remember as I was on that bus, I was wondering, see, I don't think my dad is afraid of death. And that was an important thing. I don't think my dad's afraid of death, because I was. See, as a youngster, I knew, see, of this spiritual despair. Because underlying the whole game, see, we think that some of the suffering that we go into, see, this sort of trendy suffering, where we can go to the right kind of group and we can talk about it, see, and we can luxuriate in the individual suffering that I'm undergoing. It's wonderful. It's trendy. Until people get tired of talking to you about your trendy psychological states. See, but there isn't anything trendy when you touch true spiritual despair. See, true spiritual despair. See, it's anxiety producing. It's fearful. And it's something that most of us won't address. See, we'll try to carry a facade. See, we'll try to act as if we aren't terribly, terribly concerned with the outcome of the game. This is what Buddha, and I've talked about this all of the time. See, our lives, in the way that we normally experience them, see, is a lose-lose situation. Gyonin's mother is, at what, 85? 79? See? We draw toward the end. See? We draw toward the end. We're sort of like waves, if you see it, rushing toward the shoreline. See? In my own, this is her mother. Is your father still alive? Okay. See? Shindo's mother is gone. His father's still there. His father's in his mid-80s. See? The reality is they're waves, and they're going to hit the shore. And when they hit the shoreline, what happens? They dissolve. They break down. The elements return. The elements of the great ocean return to the great ocean. And then what we don't want to think about, the Mazin is actually already in a different set. Surfers could tell. She's setting up on the shoreline. See, of hers, she's the next wave. I'm the next wave that's going to hit the shoreline. See, that's just a guarantee. See, you cannot avoid that. And it is within that, see, my attachment to this illusory body. See, my attachment again. See, Roshi would say, there's nothing wrong with desires. Don't be attached to them. The interesting part about it, see, is if we can eliminate, see, the attachment. And how do we do this? We don't eliminate the attachment, see, by an act of will. It can't be done. See, the third noble truth, see, for the Buddha, see, is the truth of extinction and the extinction, see, of our suffering. See, and our fear and our anxiety and our anger and our greed, the extinction of that, see, comes by applying the proper treatment, application of right treatment. And what and how do I do that? Well, Buddha, because it is difficult to understand, see, they do talk, and Buddha talks in the Diamond Sutra, and he talks about in the pranya. See, I found it wonderful for a Sanskrit pronunciation. It's not prajna. See, that's the way we, it's pranya. See, but anyway, see, it's difficult to understand. So Buddha talks about the things that we can do, because what we're trying to do is find the transformation that takes place within us, where we become transformed as sentient beings that are tied into the ego realm, and we try to slip free from the ego realm, which is an illusory realm that we bind ourselves through our seeing, our hearing, our tasting, our smelling, our touching, our thinking. See? And if that transformation takes place, it's right where you're at. See? You simply drop the attachment. First attachment to the self. See, it is the attachment that's the problem. And it's an interesting thing about this. If I can cut the attachment. And there's a way we can do this. We have a practice, and we have, and this is the raft that the Buddha gave us. We can apply the practice, the application of treatment. The practice is the treatment. Properly applied, it will cut the causal factor. If the causal factor is cut, see, then we're no longer, see, trapped in that realm of pain and suffering. Then we have transcended, and it's called, see here, if you want, the perfection of the personality. How do I go about it? I've said it's not enough just to misuse the medicine and misuse the diagnosis. We have to have a proper application. And so for the fourth noble truth, Buddha gives us the eightfold path. The eightfold path. And we all know, I've been going through that, see? But you know what it is. It's right livelihood, right effort. We've gone through these, see? But now what this means that in your day-to-day activity, you have to apply. See, you have to apply. This is where Roshi would say, you act as if. And I'm getting to the point about what our practice is, because our practice is so absolutely amazing. See, the great Zen masters, and in a certain sense we can say that the Shakyamuni Buddha was the first Zen master. See, master of what? Zen. What is Zen? The way. Not Buddhism. The way. And Dogen plays a little bit with that. See, he said there's just Buddha Dharma. Again, what's the definition of Buddha? Awakened. There is just the awakened way, and there is the way where we're asleep. The sleep state is maintained by the illusion, see, and the desires. The desires that are derived from the illusion of separation. See, the three great poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance. Ignorance, see, is the illusion of separation. Now, how do you get rid of that? See, how do we eliminate the cause of our suffering, which is this sense of separation? And most of us in here at varying degrees know exactly what we're talking about. You feel you are separate from the person next to you. And that sense of separation presents you then with all sorts of problems and issues that you have to deal with. See, one of the things, annoyance. Annoyance, what does it mean? It means that somebody is treading. See, somebody is intruding into this illusory body in a way that I take offense to. See, that's the pushing away. Or if I really am taken with what occurs, then I try to grasp. See, it is illusory. You cannot hold it. See, but again, we sit down on a cushion. Buddha comes down. These people who say that you don't have to sit. And the vast majority, probably the teachers today, that's what they're trying to tell you. And if you'll notice, see, the more abbreviated the treatment, the slicker it becomes, the more expensive it is. Because they figure they're going to have one strike on you, and boy, they want to make it big, and they want to make it deep. See, but the truth is, all Buddhas come through the sitting form. It is the sitting form, see, here again is the application of treatment, to sit down, and we begin to thoroughly understand what my life is all about. And we enter into samadhi. But the Buddha gave us the eightfold path. So as you go into your day-to-day activities, see, you try to apply them. See, and it's very difficult in a certain sense. But again, we have to look at the time, see, when Buddha taught. And he brought about something that was unique. See, he diagnosed with 100% accuracy, see, the disease of all sentient beings. See, he put his finger, he found that spot, see, where we find this despair. And then there's nothing worse than this spiritual despair. See, you can drop into such deep despair, that there is no hope. See, I was telling Mazen today that was part of the thing that for me was so amazing about working with my teacher. See, probably he'll never be famous. As far as I know, probably there'll be other people. That's why I sometimes wonder. But you can catch it in the readings. You can catch it in the words. But do we have an accurate picture? There are people today that are thumping themselves as the greatest teachers out there. And these are some of the most disturbed, destructive personalities. And you only have to look and see what spins around them. This is cancer turning. And in the world of samsara, we can't even think clearly. Now, this is important. See, it is important that you begin to see clearly. See, not caught in dogma. See, not caught in blind bias and discrimination. That's in the world, of the egocentric mind. See, and it is delusional, and it is destructive, and it is greedy, and it continuously turns. I don't care if there are some good things out there, some good charitable works. Ultimately, like Maizumi Roshi said, no matter how benign and brilliant, it will always cause trouble. I think in terms of when the big tsunami hit. See, and I believe this was where it was. And I immediately got on the computer and I made this donation to a very famous charitable organization. See, charitable organization. And for me, it was a substantial donation. Because people were hurt and suffering, and you do what you can. Only to find out that this good charitable organization misused the money. The money did not go to the people who were suffering. They used it to further their own concerns. See, so we talk about charitable organizations. So long as they're driven behind ego, and it will always be that way in the world of samsara, they will cause additional pain and suffering. So Buddha gave us, a way of beginning to apply, this teaching, this diagnosis, and this raft that he gave for us, and it's called the Eightfold Path. Now, you don't want to think of the Eightfold Path as eight separate characteristics or features of a human being, of a sentient being. It's much like the precepts. Within each of these steps, if you look at right livelihood, you can find all of the other steps included in that. But you have to be aware of how you're functioning. Right livelihood means, and sometimes we can't get the ideal situation. There are ideal kinds of livelihoods that would allow you ample time, ample funds, so that you could truly promote your physical health, the health of your family, you could be deeply involved in the spiritual. Sometimes we can't. But what it means is, like right livelihood, is that you don't engage in practices or activities that cause pain. Because what you have to do if you're causing pain by what you're involved in, and that pain means it's overt exploitation. And we can see that. We can see that. And if you continue to perpetuate that, you have to become hardened. You have to turn away from truth, from reality, into your imaginary world, whether you either desensitize to what you're doing, or you ignore it, or you make up a story to yourself. Now, Maizumi Roshi would say, no self-deception. No self-deception. To watch it, to be honest with yourself. What I'm doing, is it either at least neutral, but certainly not causing harm? It would be the best, the ideal, if what I do could actually help. If it could actually be productive in a very positive way. It's very difficult when we look at the complexity of the world of samsara. See, but these eightfold paths, you can, Ento has a little, these little magnets, slap it up on the wall. You can look at it, you can look at the precepts. There are people who are beginning to work with the precepts, and it's a kind of a complicated thing for them. And I'm realizing already, see, that is sort of difficult because they want to come to an intellectual understanding of the 10 grave precepts. And that isn't how you work with any of these things. It isn't even the way you work with a koan. It isn't a question of sticking badges on yourself and saying, now I understand. No, you cannot understand. See, and that is one of the first things that you have to grasp from the Buddhist teaching. See, it is inconceivable. The precept practice is that you take one of the precepts and you live with the precept. On the cushion, you live with the precept, you look at it from the perspective of a koan practitioner, where you simply hold non-killing in your mind. You hold till there is nothing else but non-killing. See? And if you can hold that thought, if you can hold the focus on that thought, see, and you keep allowing it to settle in the hara, non-killing. See, non-killing, and just non-killing. See, people don't realize how to work. You hold that until there is an explosion. And the explosion occurs when you are no longer entertaining yourself with the discriminating consciousness. And very few people have the courage or the discipline to stick with it. And at some point, when the egocentric mind can no longer move, when it is frozen in this samadhi, a little explosion takes place. And all of a sudden, you see this precept in a different way. Now, that's when I sit on the cushion. But throughout the course of the day, watch, see, and see killing. And then you can look and see, well, what does killing actually mean? And if you try to apply this in samadhi, if you bring the focus down into the hara, why into the hara? Get out of this. See? See? Get out of this. Then we're leaving this to become very, very clear as we focus here. And the old master called this the center of the universe. And something does change. See, you'll have all of these frivolous, superficial people who will make a joke of this, who have never actually had a koan open, to see the transformation that it can bring about. And then through the course of the day-to-day activities that you engage in, to see where is this killing? See, and what does killing mean? See, one of the old masters said one of the greatest teachings he had was when he carelessly, as a young kid, threw away a chopstick working in the kitchen. And he said it was one of the greatest teachings, and he sat for 4 or 5 hours while his teacher talked to him about non-killing and the life, see, of a chopstick. Now we can take another jump. If you can truly enter into this body of oneness, see, and to see in the body of oneness what killing means, see, it is to transform the personality. It's not to load you up with more BS, intellectual BS. And that's what goes on for the main part. So we have to apply it. Remember, if there is no transformation in your life, if you're functioning in the same old ways, if your anger, your fear and insecurity, your overblown sense of your own importance, see, your confrontational nature, if there is not that 180 degrees of transformation, your practice is wrong. Your practice is wrong. I didn't say that. Maizumi Roshi says it, and I repeat it. See? Now, when we find out the diagnosis to the problem, and that's why we're here, there is something. See, and Buddha talked about the worst form of suffering is this real low-grade level of suffering that most of us don't even tap into. But it is that sense of despair. See, and we'll gloss over it. See, But now it becomes a question about how do we work, see, to perfect the personality and to eliminate the suffering of samsara. And this is the beauty of our practice. This is the beauty, see, of the application, see, of Buddha mind, see, the enlightened mind. See, Zen, the way, is so simple and direct. Now the great, see, I was tying this into Muso Soseki. It's kind of hard because my vision is like looking through a wet windshield now. See, Muso Soseki states our condition so simply. This is Zen. See, and this is what you're engaged in. And those of you who wear the roksu, see, and those of us who wear the robe, see, we truly have taken on this Zen way. See, the way of the way. That's a wonderful, see, the way of the way. Roshi would say, you do Zazen for the sake of Zazen. And if you put anything else in front of it, see, you're missing it. There is ultimately no means of safeguarding anything in the world. See, now we're looking here, see, at what the Buddha looked at in identifying the Four Noble Truths. See, and our attachments, see, to this illusory body, what we call our desires. He said there is ultimately no means of safeguarding anything in the world. Anything you gain can be lost, destroyed, or taken away. Anything that comes from the conditioned world. Great wealth. Some of you don't have as much great wealth as you did have. See, and there are some folks that hit such despair. Can you imagine in such insanity the richness of... Some have committed suicide when their wealth was gone. See, it was illusory. See, you can never, never hold on to anything. There is no guarantee. And when you find yourself in that box and they're closing the lid over you, tell me what you can hold on to. Nothing. See? He said, for this reason, if you make the acquisition and retention of the retention of goods or status your aim in life, this is a way to anxiety and sorrow. How beautifully stated. See, we don't need to go into any more religious jargon. See, you cannot hold anything that comes from the conditioned world. And then he gives us the simple and direct instructions for attaining our liberation, see, from the chains of samsara. This is one of the great masters, see. And understand his life itself. See, tells you about the illusion of dualistic religions. See, he understands, see, where the problem comes from. But he doesn't tell you that all of a sudden you become a zombie with your eyes looking 3 feet ahead of you with a little smile on your lips and involved in nothing. This is considered the father of the Japanese Zen gardens. And his poetry is exquisite. It's quite beautiful. This is a man who lived, see, in the most robust sense of beauty and emotion that a sentient being can experience. It has to be freed from its attachment. See, this attachment, once we cut the attachments, see, then we can look out, see, into reality as it is. And the crazy kinds of desires that are harmful no longer appeal. It's just that simple. See, you can just simply say, if you put that needle in your arm and you hammer it enough, it's going to kill me. Why would I want to do that? See, and yet you watch people who do those kinds of things. If I go out and I bang my head with something long enough, it's going to destroy me. See, and it isn't going to allow me to progressively each and every day enhance my appreciation for life. I don't know about some of you, but I hope I've learned this one. See, I know hammer myself now at my age, I have to take 4 or 5 days to recover. Those are 4 or 5 really important days. Because you don't even know if you're going to have that much time for recovery. And there are times there where you kind of hope you don't. To cut the pain and suffering. But watch yourselves. How often for a momentary diversion? See, a instant gratification. And I don't even like that, because the truth of Zen is an instant gratification of the most profound sense. But watch your activities. That's the Eightfold Path. See? He says here again, simple and direct instructions. See, for attaining our liberation. He said, those who seek liberation for themselves alone cannot become fully enlightened. See, and again here, you can see where arguments, see, but this man is so just such an amazing, and again, you know, the sun at midnight and dream conversations, wonderful. Did you get those books, or they're not? They're out of print, okay. Yeah. But it's a wonderful, this must have been an amazing gentleman who really had a tremendously strong practice. See, this genius, see, he never allowed his back or his side to touch the sleeping mat for 20 years. He sat in Zazen. And what, was he a zombie? No, read his poetry, see, in Zen, see. And his teaching was gentle. Look at a Zen garden. What kind of an aesthetic did he have? See, how many people, see, had had the ability to appreciate the sheer beauty of this Buddha mind? Though it may be said that one who is not already liberated cannot liberate others, the very process of forgetting oneself to help others is itself liberating. See, this is Roshi saying, act as if you're enlightened. So you constantly are working to drop the self. See, you simply look out and see what needs to be done. And you'll know when you get that little rush, see, of self-aggrandizement. See, oh, yes. Then you drop it. See, all you have to do is bring it to the awareness. There I am doing that. See, because it's hard. I talked about this from lots of different ways. See, it's not an easy thing to shake, see, this sense of separation. But what is he already talking about here? The very process of forgetting one's self. See, the recognition of the Four Noble Truths is the diagnosis of what afflicts us. And he also gives us the treatment and the application through the Eightfold Path. But the Zen masters, they absolutely, it's there. And this old master, see, I will take his simple lines and I will apply it at each stage along the way. And he is there 100% accurate. So he has simplified it for you. You don't work for the self. And though it may be said that one who is not already liberated cannot liberate others, see, and that's true, because to that extent that shadow of egocentric self, it will cause a bias. But, see, here, and he acknowledges that there can be instant enlightenment and gradual. Most of us are on the gradual. As a matter of fact, there was never the separation. I think other people to do this. Insight is always instantaneous. But an insight isn't enough. It has to have application. And the application, see, is this gradual thing that the great Hongzhe talked about. You can have the insight, but then you have to grind it. You have to polish it. You have to wear it out. See, until you manifest, see, as this one great body. Now, don't act like you don't know where that one great body is. You cannot leave it. See? But you can keep yourself entangled. See, in this illusory, see, illusory attachment, see, being. It's like a film, little stinky oil film, see, that floats on the surface of this great eye. See, free yourself from it. See, but it takes application. You have to make the effort. This man, see, made supreme effort. Therefore, those who seek to benefit themselves alone actually harm themselves by doing so. See, every time you have that little greedy sense of I'm taking okay and the hell with those people out there, see, you harm yourself. In the world of oneness, see, what is a chopstick in the world of oneness? Is there anything out of this amazing body, see, of enlightenment? See, this is your mandala. See, where you stand, think about how you reject, how you push away. Think about how we become annoyed with what's in our mandala. See, that annoy. That's why you're in pain and suffering. This old master, as from the Shakyamuni through the great line to my teacher, said, if we can free ourselves from this film of ego, then you experience the life where you are in a totally different way. The great Dogen Zenji said about our sitting, it's simply the doorway to what? Boredom, pain, no, to repose and bliss. See, to frolic. And Dogen said it, as did the great Hongzhi, to frolic in a samadhi of bliss. Are you doing that? Is this what you're experiencing? See, after the stage of unification, this is the stage of oneness, said various subtle capacities and functions appear spontaneously. This is the thing in the koans. See, teacher, wait for certain kinds of things. It appears spontaneous. See, it isn't something that you try to produce. See, it is here. It has never been hidden from us. See, but I keep myself locked, see, in separation by supporting, maintaining the illusory body. See, by my attachments. To the myriad, see, illusory bodies that appear. The methods employed by such adepts for helping others thus derive from freedom. See, when we truly can help, see, it's an amazing thing. See, it spontaneously occurs. They are not products of conventional learning. That kind of help is driven from the dualistic mind. And it simply doesn't. This is what we talked about with big charitable organizations. Yes, they can help. But ultimately, the world of samsara still exists. See, unless you see where the problem rests with you. It doesn't rest with the exterior world. So long as you work at it from that perspective, see, the great charitable organizations will be out here, separate. When you invite them in, see, then you can function in a different way. I don't know, it seems so simple, don't you see? Just drop that. And it has no body. You can't see it, you can't weigh or measure, but drop it. You are the center. See, this quality of freedom and spontaneity is referred to as being alive. See? Such people are said to have attained both intent and expression, and what they say is called the living word. People meditating on the fundamental carry out their ordinary tasks and activities in the midst of meditation and carry out meditation in the midst of ordinary tasks and activities. There is no disparity between meditation and activity. See, if you walk away from sitting, what is the state that we're working in? We're working in the state of samadhi. Samadhi simply means non-distracted awareness. Non-distracted awareness means, are you sitting and talking to yourself behind your eyes? Boy, that thought shot through there. Do you confess? See, this, again, don't make it complicated. See, and if you can't grasp this state, see, of non-distracted awareness, it means go to your breathing. Try to be conscious of your breathing. See, and eventually, spontaneously, you'll begin to see this space. See, you will become empty. See, like this, it becomes mirror-like. Mirror-like, simply looking out here. And then this is what I work with. And then I try to sustain that. That's what he's taking. In all of your activities, it becomes meditation. It's easiest to see this in our retreat. This is a pitch for next week. We're doing a little sesshin. But I mean, it's a three-dayer. You could come in with tremendous intensity. See, and see this state. Now hold this state. Now, when it slips away, pull it back. But don't pretend to yourself that you're holding it when you don't. Don't pretend when you leave here and you go back into your daydream world, you go back into the world of attachments. See, a state of samadhi means non-distracted awareness. You're not attached. See, you're here. And the more you can sustain this, the more you look out here. See, the less likely you are to be pulled into those dark channels. See, of desire that is destructive. It is for those as yet incapable of this. See, it seems to me that it is so clear, and some of you should see this. Now do you have the guts? See, when you're not in a fancy situation in front of the teacher, proving to the teacher how much you know, see, when you're alone, where there is nobody observing you, you know those dark, boring places? Can you sustain the practice there? That's what you have to do. Because that dark, see, non-rewarding place, that is a Buddha field that you have managed to trash. See, this is what he's telling you. Wherever you stand, see, Roshi would say, cover the ground where you stand. To see that, to do, see, some of you know this. Now, when you find yourself going back into the habitual patterns, see, that's the attachment. And that's destructive. Stay awake. Stay awake. And he says here, for people meditating on the fundamental, okay, it is for those, I'm sorry, I have real trouble seeing this. See, it gets like a sheet of water in front of me. It is for those as yet incapable of this, those weak in focusing their intent on the way, that special meditation periods were set up. The form that we sit in here is for those who couldn't hear the word and move with it immediately. Now, he's not putting that down. This is a man who sat in Zazen, see, 24 hours a day and didn't even lie down to sleep. The practice of meditating four times a day in Zen communities began in this matter during the 12th century. In ancient times, Zen mendicants meditated 24 hours a day. That's what we're talking about, 24 hours a day. Now, don't engage yourself in some sort of an internal dialogue about this 24 hours a day. I've been saying this for a long time. I got it. See, 24 hours a day. You stay in the state of samadhi. Don't worry about it. What you'll find, go to bed and find out. He said certain things are spontaneously manifest as you begin to deepen in this. And it isn't your make-believe stuff. See, where does this happen? It happens right here. It isn't you sitting with your eyes closed imagining things. See, that's just more delusion. Where does it happen? Where does the transformation take place? It takes place right here, right now. He has a kind of a negative line. See, he says, in these latter times, however, there were those who became monks to avoid the trouble of making a living in the ordinary world. I'm certain there wouldn't be any of our folks here. See? He said, people who really have their minds on the way, in contrast, do not forget to work on the fundamental no matter what they're doing. See, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake, no matter what you're doing. See, this is if you're really committed, see, to the realization and actualization. See, if you're sick of sickness, that's what he said. He said, yet if they still distinguish this work from ordinary activity, even as they do them to, if you just see, now I'm doing my practice in my ordinary activity. If you make that distinguish, that discrimination, see, they will naturally be concerned about being distracted by activities and forgetting their meditation. See, you have to become so totally focused on it that it simply works. I told you, and it's absolutely true, I was in a car bang-up, sitting there. And I was amazed because the things hit. I'm sitting there. Things start to move very quickly in the external world. But all of a sudden, it was in slow motion. And what I was conscious of, I was breathing in the hara. It was really amazing, sitting there, and everything seemed to move in slow motion. See, that's how your practice is supposed. It kicks in. See, it actually takes over, and the separation exists, ceases to exist. Yet, if they distinguish this work from the ordinary activity, he's saying something here quite wonderful. If you distinguish your practice, this state of non-distracted awareness, as separate from your daily activities, see, you're still in discriminating consciousness. Because, see, there is that separation of you doing something and being aware of doing a practice. See, but we sustain this effort, see, until that consciousness of separation, that consciousness of doing something, that's what you do with a koan, when you hold to it or you're breathing. You keep the focus, see, so intently there. But it has to be, you can't tie your body. You keep the mind there. And at some point, the separation drops away. And what will happen, artists do this, musicians will have these breakthroughs, we've talked about that, where you will forget it yourself for a moment. And in deep enough samadhi, amazing things, even with music. See, notes have a living body of their own. See, art, if you can drop that barrier, most amazing kinds of things can occur. You can't pretend. You can see. You know what I'm talking about. Ishan, you probably have had those moments. See, now how do we generalize to where that's what practice is about? See, until that's how you live your life. How would you like to live your life as one of those moments? Yeah. It'd be amazing, see. And that's what we're talking about. That's the reward. And there is this change in the personality. And you no longer have to strut, see, and defend your ground. Because you have no ground to defend. There is no ground that isn't yours. See. And you have the responsibility, see, for maintaining it. An ancient said, the mountains, the rivers, the whole earth, the entire array of phenomena are all one's self. Understanding that intellectually means nothing. He said, if you can absorb the essence of this message, there are no activities outside of meditation. You dress in meditation and eat in meditation. You walk, stand, sit, and lie down in meditation. You perceive and cognize in meditation. You experience joy, anger, sadness, and happiness in meditation. Yet, even this is still in the sphere of accomplishment and is not true merging with the source of Zen. So please, let's take care of it.